Well, we're going to talk more about all
that.
Quadrant as we go along, but let's move on to the levels.
Let me make a different suggestion about do this, and I'll tell you why. When I was sort of coming up with a map, kind of working on it myself, I would tend to arrange these categories. We briefly mentioned them: quadrants, levels, lines, states, and types. And I sort of arranged them in what you might call size. So it's like quadrants looked bigger, and then levels, and then lines. And it was just sort of a random kind of way of doing it. When a lot of people started applying this actually in the real world, particularly with businesses or education or psychotherapy, they said, you know, that's really not a good order to introduce them. And they started telling me why and showing me what they were doing is much better than what I was doing. So they introduce quadrants first because everybody sort of gets the I, we, and it fairly quickly. And they see that we have to honor all of those. They're all important. Don't go trying to throw them out. They then go to lines, what we call developmental lines. And the reason they do that is that those are also fairly intuitively understandable. People relate to those fairly quickly. And I'll just run through those briefly and show why. And then they go...
Let's keep it easy, Ken. You know I love that. So let's go to lines, baby. I trust you.
Howard Gardner is fairly well known for what he calls multiple intelligences. And he's just reflecting one of these factors that we can find cross-culturally around the world for thousands of years, the idea that human beings have different capacities, functions, talents, and so on. So you can have a musical talent, a mathematical talent, a kinesthetic, which means bodily capacity, sports, for example, linguistics, and so on. These different capacities that human beings have are sometimes called modules, sometimes called intelligences. So you have a cognitive intelligence, emotional intelligence. You think of a spiritual intelligence, a sports intelligence, a musical intelligence, a mathematical intelligence. We have a lot of evidence that those things exist, and they're very different. And in other words, you can be highly, highly developed, let's say, in mathematics, and really not very good at emotional intelligence. As a matter of fact, it happens all the time. And it's often the case that if you have a kind of talent in one of these modules or lines or whatever they can be called, because you have a talent there, you kind of tend to go through life playing your strong suit. And these other modules or intelligences maybe are not very well developed. So they kind of atrophy a little bit, or, you know, and whatever talent you might have had in them, you really don't have any at all. Those modules or intelligences turn out to be important for all sorts of different reasons, not the least of which is in educational system. We've learned, for example, used to sort of education meant sort of cognitive development, so sort of, you know, polish the IQ, learn the verbal stuff, and sort of get on down the road. And now we know that a lot of people really shine in other modules and other capacities, and somebody can be really great in music or really great in kinesthetics or really great in sort of interpersonal styles, and not very good necessarily in book learning or kind of IQ cognitive sort of style. So when Howard Gardner took a lot of research that was sort of out there and well understood, and kind of brought it all together in this concept of multiple intelligences, it really had a very positive impact on education across the country and really around the world, because it sort of gave people a way to formally acknowledge what they really knew was happening anyway, which is people can really shine in these various areas and not necessarily just in one. So that's very useful. It's also very useful just in everyday life, because you can sort of look at these different intelligences that you have and you can say, okay, I really want to succeed more than I am in some ways. And maybe I'm in business, or maybe I'm a physician, or maybe I'm a waitress, or maybe I'm a lawyer, or whatnot. And I seem to just, you know, be having trouble sort of succeeding. You can actually look and say, okay, my strengths in this intelligence are here, and over here, not so much. And maybe I need to actually start practicing or working on some of these other capacities that I have and that are undeveloped. It particularly comes into play in spiritual practice, because a lot of spiritual practices or lineages or traditions specialize in one kind of intelligence and not too good in other kinds. And so all of a sudden you find that you're really making progress in one area. You can meditate, you can concentrate, and you're doing really, really well, but you're not doing well in all sorts of other modules. And unfortunately, what tends to happen is the teacher will often say, well, double your efforts. You're not trying hard enough. And so you really crank up, you know, more attention to this one narrow area. What you really need is to be practicing some other practice that would help with this other type of intelligence that you're not doing very well with. We find it a lot in businesses. There are a lot of CEOs or leaders that, frankly, often are very good cognitively. They're very, very brilliant. But their interpersonal emotional intelligence sucks. I mean, they're really just nightmarish. And so they have a turnover rate that's just horrifying. But you can't tell them anything because they're so smart. So you have to actually go in with sort of armed with the research and say, look, you're doing fine, the cognitive intelligence, but in the emotional intelligence, you're just a dork. You know, trust us. We have research showing you are a dork. And they're kind of okay. They kind of look at it and sort of do that.
Now, just ask a question about the numbers of lines and the categorization of these lines. How many are there and how do we know?
Like almost all maps, much of this is kind of conventional. You sort of look at it and you can divide up what you're seeing in any number of ways. It's almost like Fahrenheit and centigrade. You know, you say centigrade, there's 100 degrees, and Fahrenheit, 212 degrees. Which is right? Well, they're both right as long as we know what we're talking about. But they're conventional ways to break it up. The same is true with levels and lines and states and types. A lot of it's conventional. It's just ways that we agree are useful to break them up. It's very hard to just really break these things into completely separate events. So even emotional intelligence, for example, depends to some degree on cognitive capacity. So they're all kind of interrelated, but you can also start to see certain of them kind of stand out and can be easily recognized and to some degrees exercised independently. We think there's about 24 of those, and they can include things from interpersonal capacity, psychosexual development, linguistic development, mathematical, musical. There are things like types of defense mechanisms, object relations, artistic capacity. These all tend to be relatively independent, not totally, relatively independent human capacities.
A defense mechanism is a line of development?
Yeah, yes, because what happens is another line of development is ego development, which really means self-development. It's not using ego in a bad way, it's using in a very healthy way. And because the self develops, wherever there's a self, there's a boundary. A healthy self has a boundary. It's like an immune system. And it sometimes, though, the immune system can get out of whack. And that happens when the self starts lying to itself, like we were talking about. And then you get a pathology, neurosis kind of thing. And since there's a developmental scale for the self, if something goes wrong at any of those stages, you get a defense. So there's a line of defenses and how they develop. There's a whole sort of unfolding hierarchy, if you will, of types of defense mechanisms that are used at these various stages of development. Fairly well researched, actually.
Okay, so these 24 lines, I've counted about 12 or 15 from what you've been talking about.
which I think is enough.
Is enough to make the point. I mean, I always wonder things like, you know, culinary skills.
I think culinary skills, if it's not a line, it should be.
It should be, Danny.
Yes,
it's very critical.
So let's add that.
Okay.
Okay. So great chefs of that. But that is a kind of skill, and it is a kind of kinesthetic and creative skill. So it's almost a line. I mean, it sort of draws on one or two really distinctive skills, and those can be highly or poorly developed in people. Here are a couple of ones that seem to be especially important. And we talked about the ones that Howard Gardner emphasizes, and they're important too, like mathematics and music and so on. There are a couple psychological lines that seem to assume a whole lot of importance for various reasons. One of them is in an individual, the line of moral development. And moral refers to we as well, but each individual carries this within themselves. And we'll talk about sort of that developmental line or the what happens in that line. One is the needs. And Abe Maslow investigated these sort of levels of needs. He called them a hierarchy of needs. And they went from physiological to kind of self-protective safety needs to belongingness needs to self-esteem needs to self-actualization to self-transcendence. In the morals line, famously investigated by Lawrence Kohlberg, also Carol Gilligan found that female moral development moved through three very broad stages, which she called selfish, care, and universal care. Incidentally, notice I'm talking levels. That's why you introduce lines first. People understand that you can be more or less developed in these different areas, and that means levels. So all of a sudden, people are comfortable with levels. We didn't start with that first, then they get very uncomfortable. So we'll just finish with lines and then come back to these stages that they found in these lines. So we have the morals line of development or intelligence, and we have the needs line. Jane Lovinger, in probably one of the really pioneering and still most brilliant psychological research, looked at the line of self-development or ego-development. And she found about 8 stages that people tend to go through in developing their sense of ego. And that's a very important line. And another extremely important line is a values line. And this is the morals line is an answer to the question, what should I do? If you ask people that, what should I do? And then analyze their responses, that's what you find. The needs line is, what do I need? What do I desire? What do I want? The self line is, who am I? Who do I identify with? How do I describe myself? And the values line is, what do I think is important? What do I think is really valuable? And a researcher named Claire Graves, also very, very brilliant research and an absolute pioneer, found that if you ask people that and really consistently study their responses, you find about 8 stages or levels or waves of development that they go through in their own values development. And that particular line has been popularized in an approach called spiral dynamics. It's just one of these 24 developmental lines, but it's an important line and it's easy to understand. So those are some of the types of modules, intelligences, capacities that human beings have. And if you actually sit down and look at them carefully, you find that like almost any organic entity, acorn, chicken, it grows and develops through a series of stages from sort of birth to maturity, if you will. And so the next thing that these psychologists tend to discover is the third item that we're talking about, which is levels or stages or waves or whatever we want to talk about. And if you introduce that just on its own, people indeed get very nervous, and rightly so, because it sounds like you're ranking people and judging people and all sorts of horrible things that nobody wants to do. And you clearly have to be careful about that. This is based on very careful sort of research. And on balance, I think it's very healthy because it allows us to gauge our own capacity for increasing care and compassion and consciousness. But it's something you have to deal with very, very carefully and responsibly. And you sort of put the evidence out and let people sort of decide if they're comfortable with it or not. But that is the levels component. So that gives us quadrants, levels, and lines. And if you, that's not the only story. There are whole lots of other things going on. But these are 3 things that we want to include. We'll get to states and types, I assume. But the levels in general, if you kind of look at it, what is very noticeable in all of these scales is that the amount of consciousness increases as you go up these scales. Most of these levels that we're talking about, whether it's in morals or in needs or in values or in self-identity, is an increasing consciousness. It expands and gets more and more and more inclusive. So in you can actually think about it as going from sort of subconscious to self-conscious to superconscious, or pre-personal to personal to transpersonal, id to ego to God. It's kind of a progression of wider and wider identification from sort of the very narrowest thing you can identify with to the very broadest thing you can identify with, which is spirit, everything that's arising moment to moment. And that tends to be the way these scales run. That doesn't mean that you have to, in order to have any spiritual realization at all, you have to be the top of these scales. There are all types of spiritual states and realizations that are possible. But just looking at the developmental levels and lines themselves, it does suggest that in any of these lines, the more you develop, in a sense, the more spiritual it becomes. The more consciousness is possible, the more compassion is possible. Even in Carol Gilligan's scale of female moral development, it goes from selfish, which is just me, to care, which is you and me, I care for you, to universal care, I care for all people. And that's a natural growth that she noticed in women. I think there's a lot of truth to that. So that's a very simple view of levels right there, which is going from sort of egocentric to ethnocentric to world-centric. And each of those represents an expansion of movement, an increase in care and consciousness. That becomes important because at some point, obviously, if we talk about how can I grow, how can I develop, and you look at this evidence here, you're going to say, well, I want more of that superconscious stuff. I want to try to grow and develop in some of these areas to increase my own capacity for awareness and consciousness. And so that's something we also get into as well. It obviously plays into various spiritual approaches and psychotherapy and growth and development.
So just to take things slowly here for a moment, before we really move on from lines, can we put these 24 lines into all four of the quadrants? Does that make sense?
You can. And let me also, when we're talking about these developmental lines, right now we're focusing on an individual person, and we're saying what is present in the individual eye. The upper left quadrant is where we usually put the eye. All of these quadrants have their own developmental lines and levels. So if you look in what we call the upper right quadrant, which means an it, the objective world, a classic developmental sequence there is atoms to molecules to cells to organisms. That's a developmental sequence. That's an evolutionary sequence going from smaller to bigger. And that actually happens. First there are atoms, and then atoms join together into molecules. Molecules join together into cells. Cells join together into organisms, and so on. So that's an actual developmental line with levels in it. And only it's of its. Those are all objects. They can all be stated in it language. We're talking about them now. They're third persons. We're not talking with them. But on the interior, we're talking about what's going on in an eye. And that's when we're talking about values and needs and so on. And so that's the levels and lines in the interior. The lower left is we, or cultures, groups, and they go through their own levels and lines in certain ways. And we can talk about that too. And the lower right, which is its, or systems, ecosystems go through stages. Stellar development goes through stages and so on. So each of the quadrants have levels and lines.
But these 24 or so individual lines, those really apply to development in the upper left.
That's correct.
In the individual eye. We're not really trying to understand how those look in the other three quadrants.
Not right now.
Okay.
And ultimately, though, none of these can be separated. That's kind of the interesting thing about the four quadrants, or I, we, and it, or the good, the true, and the beautiful, is that they're both different, but they're sort of different aspects of the same thing. You sort of think about it as a mountain with four faces to it, or a diamond with different facets to it. The most accurate is a dimension, like height, length, or width. If you have a book, it has length, it has width, and it has height. And none of those can really exist apart from each other. I mean, you never find length without width or height. I mean, it's just, you know, and you don't have width without length and height, but they're different. I mean, I know what that means, and they're different. But they also intertwine. And the four quadrants are four dimensions of every event. And that's why we try to keep I, we, it, and its in mind, because they all kind of go together, even though they're as different as length, height, and width.
Well, this is helpful to me, because I think one of the ways that I've gotten confused in your work has been trying to sort of simultrack whatever's happening in the upper left in the other three quadrants and not finding direct correlations and thinking that I was sort of losing the effectiveness of the map.
Right.
But what you're saying is that you have to understand each form of measurement in its
Terms. Exactly. And here, let me just give you a really quick example of how there are correlations, but that you don't want to get sort of overly obsessive about them. We're talking about the interior of an eye, and we're saying that there are levels of consciousness from subconscious to self-conscious to superconscious, or there's levels of moral development, like Carol Gilligan found, from selfish to care to universal care. Now, when a female, let's say, is in the stage of selfish, that's her upper left. In the upper right, there's some brain chemistry that's going on. There's some brain pattern that's going along with that. So there is a correlation. And every state of consciousness has some brain state associated with it. If you're doing Zen Buddhism, you have a Satori, there's a brain state that goes along with that. So there are correlations in all of these, but they're as different as length, height, and width, even though you can't really ultimately separate them. So we're saying a couple of things when we use the quadrants. One is, don't try to reduce one to the other, because you can't do that. You can't reduce Satori to brain chemistry. It doesn't work. It has completely different qualities. It looks different. It feels different. At the same time, you can't separate them. Nobody's ever had a Satori without it registering in the brain, ever, as far as we can tell. So we're just trying to say, keep all of these things in mind. And don't reduce them to each other. Treat them in their own right. And so the fact that they're different aspects of the same thing, both of those are important, the difference and the sameness. So particularly when we look at the quadrants, we look at the differences, and we're trying to say, okay, this is what you want to pay attention to if you're looking at the interior states and stages of human beings in terms of your own self-understanding, or how, if you want to interact with people and get a better understanding of them. And so these are what these maps of these interiors are about. So right now we're looking at the interior aspects.
Okay, and just a couple more questions about lines. So I could imagine a business executive who says, you know, cognitively, yeah, I'm great, and when it comes to musical skills, right, I'm not so great. But, you know, I don't really care about my musical skills, right, using that example. I mean, right, I've got a lot else going on. I mean, you expect me to be developed in all 24 lines? That's unrealistic, especially if someone might be particularly gifted in a certain area.
Right.
Then that takes a lot of their attention. They don't have time to develop
That's
in
right.
all of these other areas. I mean, maybe the goal isn't to develop in all 24 lines.
Yeah, I don't think that's ever the goal. Here's but sort of two parts to that answer. For the particular business executive, yeah, it's okay that you're not good in music. It's okay that you're not good in the culinary line,
the Simon Wilbur
culinary line. I think we're going to introduce that. And we'll go down in history by naming this line after. So, although probably neither one of us can cook. And that's
my mother, who was a very good cook, would be glad to hear that this was my contribution to the integral model.
It's okay that the business CEO isn't shining in can't run a 4-minute mile and all those other things. But if you get to a couple of key capacities, like interpersonal capacities, emotional intelligence, and ethics, and they're really low in those, it's gonna catch up with them sooner or later. And so what we try to do, the people that are using integral business management, when they go into a company like this, is they'll actually look at the leaders, the managers, and so on, see where their strengths and weaknesses are. And there's a very simple rule. It's very hard to make an integral person. It's pretty easy to make an integral team. So one of the things that you want to do is have a little self-awareness. You want the CEO to, at the very least, say, okay, you know what? I'm not good at interpersonal stuff. I should stop assuming that I am, because I'm alienating everybody around here. And sooner or later, particularly in today's climate, somebody's going to say, oh, by the way, your ethics is that of a worm. And unless you want to go the way of Enron, you know, you better really, really get your act together here. And if you yourself can't become ethical, you better hire somebody who has the equivalent of universal care level of development, or you are screwed. So they sort of tend to listen to that, if for no other reason, the threat of jail, so to speak. It's classically their partial, lopsided development that gets them into trouble. This doesn't mean that you can't specialize. Like we're saying, Olympic athletes tend to specialize in one area. It doesn't mean they're going to be very good in other areas. That's okay. What you're looking for to have a kind of an integral, we call it integrally informed orientation, is that I can be integrally informed. Doesn't mean that I have to excel in all 24 of these lines. It does mean, though, that I don't try to deny them, repress them, ignore them, or pretend that they're not there. So it's okay that I might not be well developed in some of these other areas, but what I want to do is be aware of that. And particularly if I'm interacting with people, or particularly if I'm teaching, I have to be aware of where my strengths are and where my weaknesses are. But it doesn't mean that you have to be the sort of the equivalent of a decathlon, you know, Olympic star in all 24 lines. To be integrally informed, it just means be aware that they're there, know what your strengths and weaknesses are. And if you're actually trying to accomplish a goal that requires other capacities that you're not very good at, then you really better look at that. And nowhere does that become more obvious than spiritual teachers, because they tend to really excel in certain lines very well. They have the superconscious level in some of these lines, and they have a subconscious level in some of these other lines, and it gets them in trouble every single time. It's power, food, sex, money. It's any of these things that they haven't given attention to, and they think that just because they're excelling in one line, they're super people in other lines, and usually they're not. And so at the very least, you want them to start making that kind of integrally informed decision based on a more complete map of these possibilities. And that's one of the things we try to do when we work with spiritual teachers, is just give them a little bit of an orientation about where their strengths and weaknesses are, so they can stop inflicting their damaged parts of their psyche on their students, as if that's part of the spiritual practice.